Hello, everyone. This is Michael McCurdy from TestyMom.com. And today I have Karen Quinn, the Testy Mom, with us as well. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Doing wonderful. Thank you. We've gotten several questions over the last week as the here in New York City, for those in New York City, as you know, the OLSAT test will begin in approximately 3 weeks, and it'll, depending on the time that you have scheduled with the DOE, it can, the starting date is from January 8th, I believe, till March 3rd. So in that window of time, your child will be taking the test for those parents here who are located in New York City and New York City public schools looking to get into the Gifted and Talented program. We have about 10 questions we're going to cover today, and we'll just dive into the questions and we will answer these. And if anyone in the audience has questions, feel free to chime in as we go through each of these questions. And this will also be recorded and available on testymom.com probably in the next day or two. The first question we have today is, when does the school notify parents when their child will take the exam? I know the dates for next year. I'm looking for a time period, 1 week before the exam, et cetera. Usually the way it works, it's usually it's minimum 1 week, usually 2 weeks. You'll get a notification from the DOE giving you the actual date of the exam. I'm not sure. It also depends on if you're, I believe the child in this case is in a public school. So if your child's in public school, in my case, when my daughter, she was in pre-K public school, we got the notice, I believe, about a week before that she will be taking the exam on this day. We were not given the exact time of the exam. She was in pre-K, so she was a one-on-one situation given to a test via a test proctor. So usually it's about 1 week or so, in my experience. So that's usually what I hear from other parents as well. So you should get notice a minimum 1 week, if not longer. It's usually
Michael, and I just want to clarify, you're talking about here, this is for New York City, and this is for children who are in a public pre-K. Is that right?
Yeah, this is for public pre-K, but also if you sign up, if your child is in private school and you're taking the exam on a weekend, the weekend test, OLSAT test, you should get your notification from the DOA hopefully sooner than a week or 2 weeks. You have to go through a prioritization and you pick the days that you want. Mm-hmm. And I believe those people get them probably 2 weeks in advance so they can, you know, adjust schedules, et cetera. But it's a lot easier to accommodate the kids or the child if they're actually in a public school, because if by chance your son or daughter is sick, you know, and they're already in the school, they can make up the test easily. Whereas, you know, if they're in a private pre-K and then they have to go somewhere, they'll have to reschedule through the DOE. So it's a little more difficult to do that as well. Looks like a couple more people have joined us on this call as well. And the next question go ahead.
Yeah, Michael, Steve Hollowell again. Yeah, that was my question, and thanks for that. You keep saying pre-K, but I'm assuming, obviously, if they're in kindergarten, it's the same thing, 1 week before at least.
Oh, yeah, yes. Your child will be you'll be getting a note from the DOE saying your child will be taking this test, you know, on X day. You won't get the exact time, but
right.
So, but you can, you know, in that setting, you have to keep in mind your child will not be the teacher will not be giving the test to your child. It'll actually be a test proctor.
Right. I've got that. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sure. And the next question here, it's, will my daughter take the exam with one or more examiners, or will it be one-on-one? She's in a public school. I would check with the public school and I believe this is your question as well, Stephen. I would check with the school to see. Believe it or not, it varies from school to school. I know in pre-K, if your child's in pre-K, it's a one-on-one situation with one examiner. I've heard kindergartens, it fluctuates. It depends on how many kids, students are taking the test in the kindergarten class. It can be a small group of 3 to 5. They usually don't go more than 5. But if there are situations where it's a one-on-one situation in kindergarten as well. So what I would do is check with the school, check with the teacher to see if they know how the test is going to be administered in the kindergarten class. There doesn't seem to be, from what I've heard from other parents, I've heard some parents say, you know, their kindergartner took it and it was a one-on-one situation, and then other parents have told me their kindergartner took the test and it was a group setting. Now, once your child does get in first grade, at that point, it will be a group setting. But there doesn't seem to be consistency from, and this is what I'm hearing from other parents, as far as, you know, if it's a group setting or one-on-one.
Okay. All right.
Okay. When answering the questions, does the child need to mark an answer sheet or tell the examiner verbally? If the verbally, does the examiner mark the answer sheet? Now, in kindergarten, your child will be required to mark the sheet. If they do have trouble marking the sheet, the examiner can help them as long as they're, like, you know, pointing to the answer as well.
Right.
So, I mean, it can help somewhat, but the keep in mind the examiner or the test proctor cannot redirect the child at all with the exam, within the exam. And what I mean by redirection is your child loses focus. They cannot repeat the question. They can encourage the child to say, okay, which do you think is the best answer? But they can't repeat the question to say, okay, repeat, is it this one, is it that one? So the main thing is to just, try to build your child's confidence and feeling comfortable answering and being really confident in their answers as well.
Right.
Karen, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that's fine, what you just said. It's true.
Okay.
So, go ahead. You're doing great.
I'm going to get to meet you soon. You have a lot of questions, too, so I'm
on
a roll here as well. And if I know a few people have just joined us, so if you have any questions, looks like we have several people joining us right now. If you have any questions, feel free to chime in as we go through the questions. And, again, if you just joined us, this teleseminar will be recorded, and it'll be on testymom.com in the next couple of days, so you can hear the first part if you just joined us in the last couple of minutes or so. The next question is, can the child change her answer before the examiner moves on to the next question? Yes, the child can change their answer. They can't keep changing it multiple times, but if the child's like, no, it's this one, if they say one and they're like, oh, no, it's this one, they can change the answer. It's my understanding it's kind of a case-by-case basis. It's not like one of those things where they're three questions down and then they go back up three questions. I haven't heard that be the case. I have heard if they're within that same question and they say, oh, it's this one, and then they, like, immediately go, oh, no, it's this one instead. There are some flexibilities, especially when you're dealing with pre-K and kindergarten students. Most test proctors I've heard are very supportive and very nice, but it's also they have to get through this exam in a timely manner. So they really want to encourage the child to give their best answers, but also do it in a timely manner. So they don't want the child to spend a ton of time, second guessing their answers as well.
Right. Okay.
Michael, I think somebody's got their phone on speaker, and so we're hearing an echo. Do you want to mute everybody and tell everybody how to unmute if they have a question?
Yeah,
we'll try that and see if that works. If it doesn't, I don't know. We've got a big echo here.
Is that better?
No.
Let's see here. Okay, is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I had to mute someone. I was guessing who it was. Okay.
Okay. And if someone needs to unmute, how do they do it if they have a question?
Unmute, you should do, let's see, participant unmute should be star 2.
Okay.
Star 2 on your phone should unmute you.
Okay.
And the next question here is a great question because actually I went through this process myself. The next question here is, will the parents see the exam? And we're talking about the New York City Gifted and Talented exam for those who have just joined us, and her answers after the examination. The way it works here in New York City for the Gifted and Talented program for the OLSAT test, that you will be able to review your child's exam. One thing to keep in mind is you will have to schedule a time with the DOE to actually review the exam. You'll have to schedule it, and the DOE is downtown on Chamber Street. I believe it's 400 Chamber Street. It's near the courthouse area downtown in downtown Manhattan. And what you have to do is schedule your time. They're very stringent up on the times that you can go actually review the exam. You have to be there exactly at the time. You have exactly 15 minutes to review the exam. You will sit there. Someone will be across the table from you. You cannot touch the exam. You cannot. It's bizarre. I don't know how else to explain it, but it's like the Declaration of Independence, don't touch it. So it's like they literally like show you the exam and they'll flip the pages for you.
Cool.
You cannot take any photographs. You cannot take any notes. So just try to remember everything you can. And you are very limited on the 15 minutes allotment of time. And what you'll
do
is
you see the question and the answer, Michael?
Yes.
You see both. Okay.
And so you can kind of get what you'll do is when you go through the exam, you know, what I recommend parents doing is, and I highly recommend you go through the exam, go get the exam, you know, go review the exam. Our daughter, she did well on the exam, but I still wanted to know which one she missed. So I just had to know. So it's up to you. I mean, it's usually the parent, just depends on your situation and what you want to do with the, you know, with the information. And a lot of parents will see, like, it'll be maybe one category or two categories that your child may need some work in. If your child, especially if your child scores right on the cusp, you know, in the high 80s as an example, you know, they score 87, 88, 89, you know, they're right there on the cusp of getting in, but they didn't quite make it. So it's one area to see, okay, well, nonverbal reasoning or verbal reasoning or matrices. So it'll give you an indication of what areas might need improvement if you decide to take the exam later on or retake the exam, you know, the following year. So I know a lot of parents do go through the process. Please keep in mind they are very, very strict about the process of going in, looking at the exam. You cannot touch the exam. It's bizarre. I don't know how else to say it. But it's interesting. I would, you know, it's interesting to go through the process because it's like they're very strict about the exam. One thing also to keep in mind, this isn't a question, but I'll throw it in here as well. The exams, I get a lot of questions from parents as far as like the exams. You have to keep in mind the New York City public school system, they have an agreement with Pearson, who's the publisher of the OLSAT exam or the OLSAT test. And they have several, and they have specific versions that were made for the New York City public school system. And there are multiple versions of the OLSAT. So if my daughter's in kindergarten and your daughter's in kindergarten, they may take two different versions of the OLSAT. You know, different types, same types of questions, but different, you know, pictures or different, you know, they're not the OLSAT. They have several versions of the OLSAT. So it's not like, you know, all students are taking the same exact version of the OLSAT. It's just something to keep in mind because a lot of parents don't know that. Okay, Karen, I think these next questions are for you. Any other questions on that topic? These were great questions, by the way. Okay. The next question, yep. Karen. We've been getting a lot of questions from parents about workbooks. They are thinking of buying to prepare their kids for the OLSAT and Bracken test. One mother wanted to know if she should buy the Junior Test Prep Bundle, which is one of these workbooks that are out there on the market. And another wanted to know if she was better off buying the Aristotle Circle OLSAT book or just a bunch of Diana Dre's workbooks on analogies. Karen.
Okay. What I would say is that on if you go to testingmom.com and you go to Parent Resources, towards the bottom, I have reviewed all the OLSAT test prep products that are out there. And so I encourage you to watch that review. And I actually show you what each workbook looks like and just give you my opinion on which ones are the best and which ones are not so good. And you can see what's more expensive, what's less expensive. And so the best thing to do, I think, is just go to the OLSAT test prep products reviewed on Parent Resources on the website, testingmom.com, and just watch that. And that'll help you pick the best workbook, you know, that seems to feel right for you and your child. Now, Diana Dres has written a number of workbooks that you can order online on Amazon or buy in bookstores. And these are workbooks on analogies, on critical thinking, and on sequencing. And these are all skills that are needed for testing. And I do recommend these workbooks. I think they're wonderful. They're not a substitute for books that have test questions that are modeled after the actual test. But what they are good at is if you're going to have workbooks in your house, these are good ones to buy because they really support the abilities needed for testing. And so they're by Diana Dres, and on my site, Testing for Kindergarten, if you go to recommended products, I think I have them all there. So you can see which ones I'm talking about. But they're very good workbooks.
Yeah, and I highly recommend Aristotle Circle books. I've worked with those with my daughter. Even though she's not taking the OLSAT again, I like to just have her look at them to see if she likes them, and she really responds to the Aristotle.
Yeah, those are great. I agree with you. Aristotle Circle does a great job on all their workbooks. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, they are pricey, but yeah, they are very, very good and very strong content as well. Mm-hmm. One thing to keep in mind, we are opening up a store on testimom.com, hopefully within the next couple of weeks, so you'll be able to buy all the products that Karen and I recommend on our store on testimom.com. Probably sometime in January.
Mm-hmm. Only the ones we recommend, not the ones we don't recommend.
Yeah, not the ones we don't recommend. The next question here is, do you have any insights to what happens at Hunter Round 2 of testing? Karen, do you want me to field that one? Or?
Yeah, well, you can start. I have a few things to say, but you might want to start for those people who are not in New York, just what Hunter is.
Sure. Hunter College is here is a college here in Manhattan, and they have you'll hear Hunter School, and Hunter School is a school for a gifted and talented school, and it's publicly funded, but it's not part of the New York City public school system, so it's a separate entity, if you will, but it is publicly funded, and it's only eligible for residents who live in Manhattan. So you have to be a resident in Manhattan to actually have your child apply to Hunter. And Hunter is a teaching school, so it's kind of a research teaching school. It's very competitive to get in. I believe this year I'm hearing like 3,500 students apply to get into kindergarten. So your chances of getting into kindergarten are very, very tight when it comes to Hunter. Hunter, I believe it's 26 boys and 26 girls are admitted every year into the kindergarten program. And there's two rounds of testing at Hunter. Hunter uses the Stanford-Binet as the basis for the first round of testing. And your child needs to score, it varies from year to year, but the ranges over the last few years have been anywhere from a 142 to a 148 on the Stanford-Binet to actually be invited back for a round two of testing. The round two of testing at Hunter is where I think they narrow down the field between 150 to 200 four-year-olds at that point to come in, and different groups. I think each group has around 20 kids in it. And what they do is they have the students arrive, and then they, without the parent, you know, the parents bring them, but, you know, they bring the children into a classroom. And then at that point, the instructors actually observe the children, have projects with the children, see how the children actually interact with one another, see how the children take direction, see how the children respond to their questions. You know, a lot of this is, you know, kind of a secret sauce, so no one knows the exact recipe of what they're looking for. You know, from what I've heard from parents, it's like some parents have told me that their child went to the second round of Hunter, and, you know, their four-year-old son was asked, what's 6 + 3? I mean, straight up, like arithmetic. So, I mean, it's these kids, you know, they score very high on these IQ tests, but also Hunter is looking for a variety of different skill sets or different gifts and talents that each of these children may bring to the school. So it's not like they're looking for, you know, all the kids who are super math geniuses, you know, are going to be, you know, selected. They're looking for well-rounded classrooms because it is a research school. One of the things to keep in mind about Hunter is the only grade you can get into Hunter is going into kindergarten. And again, I believe it's going into sixth grade. I believe it's seventh grade as well. So there's only two chances to get into Hunter. It's going into kindergarten or going into seventh grade. And once you're in Hunter, you can stay in Hunter, you know, as long as you don't move. And you can stay in Hunter through high school. Hunter, the graduation rate and to Ivy League schools is Hunter's one of the best schools, like scores Ivy League, you know, in the nation here in the United States. And Hunter, I believe last time I checked, has around a 62% graduation rate of high school seniors going to Ivy League schools. So, I mean, the percent of, you know, Hunter graduates to go to Ivy League is like, you know, the highest in the nation. So getting into Hunter, it's really about, you know, they look for a variety of things. There's no real way to like prepare your child except in the aspect of, you know, make sure they're comfortable in group settings, make sure they're interactive, make sure, you know, they feel comfortable talking, and, you know, get them to interact with adults. And they're just looking, you know, they just want to make sure it's an observation. I believe it's around 2 hours or so, 2 to 3 hours that these children are in the room. So the teachers can really get to know a child after a few hours and see what their strengths are, see what their weaknesses are. I had, instance with my own personal situation where, a child in my daughter's class last year. He made it to the second round of Hunter, but they weren't, that he didn't make it through. And he had some discipline problems. And he was only in my daughter's class for 3 months, and he wasn't able to make it through the whole year, unfortunately, just because of the discipline problems. So one thing to remember is, like, a lot of these kids may be, you know, genius level children, but some of them may have some discipline ADHD problems as well. And those are things that these instructors are going to look at, because they want to make sure that kids that go into Hunter are teachable. And one thing to really take into consideration is your child does not need to know how to read if they make it to the second round of Hunter. You know, reading basic words and that, it's not, you know, they don't really look for that. It's like, you know, if your child's four and reading at a second grade level, it's not like they're automatically a shoo-in. So it's just, you know, really making your child relaxed, if they make it to the second round of Hunter and take it from there. Karen, did you have any other insights on that one?
No, other than the fact that when I was doing research on my book, I was able to find an article where they talked about the abilities that they were looking at, and, you know, when they did the second round. And all I could find out is that they were evaluating for problem solving, creative thinking, verbal and mathematic abilities, leadership, the ability to learn a new task, and the ability to respond to complex directions. But, you know, how they do that, we have no idea. But those are the kinds of areas that they're looking for.
Okay, the next question here. Oh, actually, we have a question from our friends up north in Canada. The question is, we live in Quebec and love the questions you send each day and your game, IQ Fun Park, Karen's game. It helped our four-year-old do well on the OLSAT, and he got into the private school we wanted him to attend. The problem is our six-year-old. He took the OLSAT last year and didn't do well because he had trouble concentrating. He's going to take it again in the spring. Is he too old for IQ Fun Park? What else can I do to help him focus when he's tested?
Okay. I would say that you can still play the game with him, even though he's six, because IQ Fun Park, it's really good for kids from about the ages of three through about six. It's really good, ideal for those age groups. But focus on the questions on the cards that have red borders, because those are the hardest questions, and those are probably more appropriate for him. And we are going to have questions on our site within a few weeks that go through third grade, so you can try some harder questions with him as well, and work with him on those. But what it seems like you need to do is really work on focusing skills. And I would start that by seeing, you know, how long can he sit down and work on a board game or a workbook, but something he enjoys. And once you kind of get a baseline of how you're able to get him to sit still and work on something, then, you know, each time you have a session to try to build his concentration, just try to push it another 5 to 10 more minutes and keep him focusing on whatever the activity is that he, starting with what he enjoys. And then you might, once you've got him working on something for up to an hour, you know, try something that he likes but doesn't love, you know, because that's kind of what an OLSAT test is like. It's kind of fun, but it's not like playing. So, you know, you want to just, you know, keep pushing him to be able to sit and work on something for up to an hour, which is about how long an OLSAT takes. So you want to make sure that focus and concentration muscle is, you know, working, and for it's working for up to an hour. Now, the other skill that's so important on the OLSAT is listening and then remembering what the tester said so you can answer questions. And one thing I would recommend you do is you can use puppets or, you know, finger puppets or regular puppets and just make up little stories to tell your child and then ask him questions about the story you just told. And you can also pick up, I've recommended these before, but storysmarts.com. And those are great because it's a whole process of telling a story and then asking your child to tell it back. And by practicing with storysmarts.com, but with their books, that builds that skill of listening, remembering, and being able to answer. And so That's something I recommend for kids who need help focusing and listening, which are just going to be such important skills for the OLSAT. And that's it. Did you want to add anything, Michael?
Oh, no. I mean, it was perfect, Karen. I think it's just building up the test stamina and trying to add a little each day. The main thing about, you know, when you start working with your child on these types of questions, I get a lot of people, believe it or not, you know, last year when the OLSAT was going on here in New York City, contacting me literally the day before, asking what they could do to prepare their child who was taking the test 12 hours later.
Yeah.
You know, the week before, there's not a lot you can do.
The main thing is to work
with your child daily and to really build up the stamina that they need to really succeed on these tests. And, you know, that's one of the things we do with these daily questions, is things you can incorporate in your daily life and, you know, the types of questions that you can just use on a daily basis as you're just walking around and going to school, going to the store. And really, because once you start hearing these questions and reading these questions yourself, you can be like, oh, well, this will be applicable when I go to the store and I can ask my son or daughter this question or that question. And then you can start incorporating it into your daily life. And that's kind of where, you know, these problem-solving skills can really get incorporated. But, you know, having your son, you know, try to sit still and really listen, it's a discipline and it's a practice, and it does take time. The next question here, Karen. My daughter is having trouble with verbal math questions for the OLSAT test. I keep trying to practice with her using the workbook we bought, but she's not getting it. What do I do?
Okay, if you're working with a workbook or you know, and you're trying to practice a certain kind of question, giving your child more of the same type of question won't help if they're not getting it. What you really need to do is take a look at what is the skill behind the practice question that maybe my child doesn't have. And so what you need to do is think about working on the real world skill as opposed to working on the workbook. So for example, you know, a typical OLSAT arithmetic reasoning question might ask, Billy ate 3 pieces of pizza and Bobby ate 2 pieces of pizza. Point to the picture that shows how many pieces of pizza Billy and Bobby ate together. That would be a typical question. And then there might be pictures of 4 pieces, 5 pieces, or 6 pieces of pizza, and your child would have to point to what the right answer was. And what you want to do is you want to make sure, well, is my child even ready developmentally to answer this question? You know, before he can answer this question, he has to be able to count and to understand what 1 really means and looks like versus 2. You know, not counting by rote here. We're talking about really understanding what numbers are and what they look like. And then what you want to do is you want to start doing addition and subtraction problems very simply using goldfish or M&Ms, you know, and like, you know, here's 2 goldfish. If I give you 2 more, how many will you have? And if your child has to count them 1 by 1, that's fine because that's how they learn how to add. Or here's 4 goldfish. If I eat one, how many's left? That's a subtraction problem, and, you know, he can see it. And so you've got to really step back and do some of those problems before your child will be able to listen to a word problem that's on a test and point to the answer. So make sure, you know, in that situation you work with manipulatives and you let him use his fingers, you know, to count, and you really work your way up to being able to answer a question that's in a workbook that's a practice test question. And it's the same, for example, with matrix questions. You know, matrix questions are analogies. A is like B the way C is like D. And so what you want to do if your child's having trouble with matrix questions is start really focusing on how things relate to each other in real life. You know, point out things that are alike because they're in the same category, or they're opposites, or they share some characteristic that makes them alike. And in fact, in my book, Testing for Kindergarten, which you should all have, there's a verbal analogy game that you can look at. It's on, I think, page 135. You could play that. But you want to do things in real life and build up the skill before you really pursue all the practice test questions, because they'll never be able to answer the practice test questions if they don't have the underlying ability pretty solid. Did you want to add anything, Michael?
Oh, no. No, that was really good. It was excellent, by the way. I learned some stuff myself. Thank you.
I'm so
like
glad I can
help
you. Like,
oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Next question here. Actually, this is an interesting question. I was actually talking to someone about this a few weeks ago. It says, our elementary school has informed us that they will be testing our son using a test called the MAP, M-A-P, all caps. Do you have any insight or familiarity with the test?
A little bit. The MAP stands for Measures of Academic Progress. It looks at achievement in math, reading, language use, and science. Kids will take it on the computer, and the questions will adjust to the level of the child. So if the questions are too hard for the child, then they automatically start getting easier ones. And if the child is answering the questions very easily and getting them right, they start to get harder. And it's a really good test because it's able to assess a lot of the sub-skills that make up a general skill. So, for example, with reading, there's a lot of sub-skills. And so it will look at things like phonological awareness, phonics, letter recognition, letter sound understanding, and a lot more. And it can tell a teacher what the child really needs to work on to advance a skill. So it's a really good tool for teachers to use to help a child. So after your child is tested, what you want to do if your child takes this test is you want to sit down with the teacher and find out what his strengths and weaknesses are, and then you can start working on some of the areas of weakness at home. Plus, you'll probably start focusing on them in the classroom as well.
Yeah, one thing to keep in, it's not only the MAP test, but we're going to see more and more tests become, on the computer or, computer-enabled tests in the years to come. It's not going to slow down. The question is, especially as we talk about the OLSAC, gifted and talented tests, what is the age that computer testing will actually start? And will it start with the four-year-olds going into the GNT programs here in New York? TBD, but the question is going to come up over time as far as, like, where does the computer testing actually, take place, and at what age is it appropriate? So it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out over the next few years.
Yeah.
So, all right.
I think those are the questions that people submitted to us. I wonder, does anyone else have any questions? Are people able to unmute? Do you know how to do that?
Yeah, let me unmute a couple people here.
In case anybody has any more questions.
All right. Yeah, does anyone have any more questions from the audience today? Okay. We appreciate everyone attending today. And if you have any other questions between now and our next teleseminar, please let Karen or myself know. Karen can be reached at karen@testingmom.com, and I can be reached at Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, at testingmom.com, or you can always reach any of us at help@testingmom.com. Thanks again for attending, and we'll chat soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.